Hey everyone, this amazing ESO Network show is brought to you by our fine sponsor, Amazon.com. Please remember to shop Amazon for all your geeky needs, no matter what time of the year it is. All you need to do is go to ESOpodcast.com/ESOAmazon or click on the Amazon banner on the ESO Network webpage to go to our e-store. It's the best way to shop and the best way to support this program, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. Okay, that's enough of me babbling for now. Now on with your regular scheduled show.
Welcome to Earth Station 1, a weekly podcast dedicated to all things sci-fi, fantasy, and much, much more. Sit back and relax and enjoy the show.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Earth Station 1 podcast. That's right, folks. We are here to talk all about Bernie Wrightson. Sadly enough, the late Bernie Wrightson. Would have loved to, you know, talking about how well he was doing and is recovering from his illness. But sadly enough, back in March, he succumbed to a very long fight he had. And we are now, sadly enough, you know, basically going, you know, Bernie was a great guy. Bernie was this, Bernie was that. And if you've ever seen his artwork, you know why we're dedicating a whole episode to him. It's definitely worth talking about. And speaking of worth talking about, let's welcome the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Mike Gordon.
Howdy.
How are you, my friend?
Things are good. Things are good. We're getting through things. And it's sad that we're doing this, that we had to move this up, or that we're doing this a tribute show, because the original plan was to honor him while he was alive. To honor his work while he was alive. But, like you said, I mean, his work, regardless of his life status, is worthy of note. And we've got some great folks, some artists to talk about it. So and go in detail about what, you know, his influence was over the entire industry, really.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So it was interesting to see, you know, how he fit into DC's mythos and other, you know, independents and movies and TV. It's amazing, you know, when we start talking about him and you're going to go, he created that, he'll created this, or he worked on this. You're going to be in for a treat, my friends. You truly are. But of course, we want to hear from you at home. Please write us esopodcast@gmail.com or call us at 404-963-9057. And this week, we actually have a friend of the show, Lee Benjamin, is going to be joining us as a victim in the Geek Seat. That's right. And he's going to be talking all about and bringing us up to date on Axnar, which is a project you've probably heard of, and because they had a little bit of a lawsuit with Paramount a little bit back. So we're going to be talking all just about that. Just a little bit. Slightly, as I like to say. So we're going to be talking all about that when if he has time to, you know, get out of the ropes of the Geek Seat, that is. Take it for what you will, as we like to say. So with that being said, let's get started with this week's episode and go for rants and raves. And Mike, we have a great topic to talk about this week.
Well, we do, and part of it is in kind of honor of Bernie Wrightson. Folks that are watching the Walking Dead as the last season finale aired, I think the last thing that you saw before the credits was that the finale was dedicated in memory to Bernie Wrightson, and some people were like, who is that? So this is one of the reasons why we're recording this episode, so more people know who he was. He was influential in a lot more than just art. I mean, we're talking about a TV show here and zombies and that whole genre. Greg Nicotero, who is the director of the finale of Walking Dead, who's directed a lot of episodes this season, this past season, is a big fan. And we're going to talk about, you know, we haven't done it for a while, talking about The Walking Dead. Season 7 ended. And I believe that the show has sort of gone back and reached some new heights. I know that Mike has a little bit of a conflicting opinion. But I thought it would be kind of interesting. Now, there may be some spoilers here. If you have not watched Walking Dead Season 7, you may want to skip this part until you have. But we're going to talk more in general of things, but I'm sure things will slip out, of course. But in any case, I am still a fan. I think The Walking Dead has stepped up a little bit. I think the introduction finally of Negan at the end of last season, and really we get to really get to know Negan this season, has just been a boost in the arm to this show. I think that Jeffrey Dean Morgan is just electric. I even like the character of Negan in the series more than I do in the comics. I think they've really done a great job with that. This season really ties together and adapts very strongly, probably more so than we've seen in quite some time, the comics. So if you're a big fan of the comics, you'll see a lot of things come to life this season. If you're not interested in the comics, then it probably doesn't mean anything to you. But I would imagine that there are some, and there are some surprises. There are some things that are not in the comics that pop up this season too. Some groups of folks, which is going to be interesting to see how they're used. And I think the whole thing about Rick trying to band together, get the group together, and have somebody that's opposing him, who's such a strong, charismatic leader, to go up against Rick is pretty exciting for the show. But Mike, I understand that you are not as impressed.
No, I wasn't actually. I thought truthfully the season was very slow, and a lot of it, I did like the character of Negan, and I do read the comics. So it was neat seeing some of those scenes come to life, but I just felt like they were hashing on and on and on. Yes, they're character building and universe building a little bit. People will claim that. But for me, I didn't find it exciting. It used to be with Walking Dead, I would basically, it would be must-see TV every week. Then it started to be an episode or two behind, or three or four. Eventually it got to almost the half season behind, and it would be like, do I really want to catch up with this? It just felt like the whole season, like this last season, moved like at snail's pace. I didn't like what they were doing with Daryl. I didn't like that they dedicated a whole episode to Tara and to, it just was like, some of these characters were kind of wasted. I felt like Daryl was a complete waste this whole season. And I just didn't feel, much of, what I was seeing in the comics. And I agree completely, Mike, with you about Negan. Negan is the best part of the show right now. I loved everything. Any scene in the show right now with Jeffrey Dean Morgan is just amazing. He lights up the screen. He eats up every scene that he's in. He even eats up, beats any of the other characters in it. You almost forget they're even in those scenes. And I just was like, is that worth watching the show for? So as of the season finale, I am officially giving up Walking Dead.
Wow.
And I won't be going back for the next season.
In addition to Jeffrey Dean Morgan as Negan, I have to say that a very high second for me, they really did a great job of casting Kerry Payton as King Ezekiel. I think that he's such a presence in the comic that I was like, oh, how are they going to handle Ezekiel? Because he's a weird guy. And, a guy with a tiger, that's going to be kind of, and I think in the comic he has two, right? I'm like, that's really going to be weird for people to see on TV because they've never really done anything like that. But I thought they really pulled it off really well. And I really appreciated the casting of him, the scenes with him. I really dug that, what was going on there too. And especially his relationship with Carol, I thought was pretty cool because Yeah, sometimes Carol is a hit or miss character for me, and where she was going at the end of last season, I was not thrilled about. But where she ends up here, and I think was actually pretty cool. By the end, she's with everybody back again, and they're much in. They're much. Next season, it's interesting that you say that, because next season I think should be balls out like. Pretty exciting, because next year I imagine is going to be a complete war between, you know, the scavengers or the saviors rather, and everybody else. So the only thing that really threw me this year was like you said, that whole episode with Oceanside with Tara. I was like, yeah, if they had broken that up so that we had gotten to see some other things during that same episode. But instead, it was really just all about Tara, which I thought that was – I didn't know what to think of that. But that was kind of a weird thing. But then again, I've noticed that, you know, that's just the way Walking Dead works. It really kind of does slow down occasionally before it picks back up. And, that was probably a low point in the season. But right after that, I thought it picked up pretty well.
Mm-hmm. It was just,
and I did like the introduction. Like, I didn't like the introduction on the Oceanside because they're not in the comics, but I did like the introduction of the scavengers. They're not in the comics either, but they're just so weird that I really appreciated them, especially the battle that Rick had in the junkyard with that weird, almost Mad Max looking, apocalyptic looking zombie that I thought, wow, they're really, that's one of the most exciting things that's happened in this show in a long time.
Well, it was interesting because when they introduced the scavengers, I thought, oh, are these supposed to be the Whisperers? And
not yet.
I know. Oh, I know. But I just was like, I just didn't find any of it fascinating. I was like, each episode, it was just like, come on, get on with it. The final episode, loved the stuff that they did, you know, with, you know, the little bait and switch with the whole thing, who was in the coffin. And I liked a little bit of that. And I liked some of the other stuff with it, but it wasn't enough to rope me back in. And it was like, almost like by that point I was ready to go, okay, that's it.
And I don't know if this has anything to do with it, but I mean, obviously since you know the comics so well, there's not going to be, I mean, right now, especially there's not going to be a lot of surprises.
No.
Because they're really towing the line very closely to the comics. So apart from a few characters that are not in the comics, like Daryl and Carol, you pretty much know like everything that's going to happen.
Oh, of course. And how they replaced the Michonne character with Carol in parts, because, you know, they, you know, got rid of other characters earlier seasons, so Michonne had to fill those roles. Exactly.
Yeah, there's been some like musical chairs, shall we say, right?
Oh, of course.
Because Carol's kind of Michonne in the comics, and Michonne in the TV show is kind of like Andrea in the comics, right?
Exactly. So it was just.
But Carl's still Carl.
Carl is still Carl, and you know. I still want to say, you know, go to the house, Carl, you know, whatever. So it was just, I'm leaving it. There's nothing anyone could say. I've lost it. And, you know, and it's lost its magic. And trust me, folks, you know, we had sections of this podcast dedicated each week to talking about Walking Dead. And, you know, to the point where people are starting to write us and say, hey, why don't you just spin another podcast off for Walking Dead to, you know, just talk about that. Not all of us watch it. You know, we don't want to hear you talking about it. That's how much we were talking about it on the show. Well, that's why we started a Doctor Who podcast. So
it's true.
And so,
well, yeah, I guess you should be glad that you didn't start the Walking Dead podcast, because then you'd be really in pain.
Oh, that's true, and I'd be compared to Chris Hardwick. So, you know, there we go.
You're always going to be compared to Chris Hardwick, sir.
Oh, yeah. That's definitely going to happen. And I thank you for that. But, no, I'm just I loved it. I really did love it. I gave it chances. And even, you know, some of these seasons, it just, you know, it was neat to see some of the stuff from the comics. Don't get me wrong. It was neat to see when Negan gutted the guy and seeing his guts spill out. It was just like in the comics. And there was some pretty neat scenes, but I don't know what I wanted, but it just wasn't there. I have so much stuff I am backed up to need to watch, and things people have been telling me, oh, you got to watch this, you got to watch that. I'm now going to go dive into it, you know, with other stuff and not have to worry about Walking Dead now on my list.
Speaking of the comic now, I'm not caught up as far as, I don't read it issue to issue. I read it by the trade.
Right.
And I think I've got the last trade to read. So
number 27 was the beginning of the Whisper War.
Yeah, which I haven't been part of that yet. So I don't know what's going on. I mean, so I'm not caught up there yet. But
okay.
How are you feeling overall, without going into spoiler, how are you feeling about the comic? Is it still on the top of your stack, or is it, because to me, the comic, obviously, since I haven't read the last trade, I have it. It's into my read pile. But it used to be that I used to grab that thing and read it all, like, first and foremost. But now
it's fallen in the comics for me.
So Walking Dead overall has the concept and everything about The Walking Dead has fallen for you.
Yeah, because, well, there's no hope. And with what's going on in the world right now, I think maybe that partly is because of this, is I need hope in the world right now. And I don't see that in Walking Dead. And, you know, people might not agree with me. And it's a very bleak storyline. And whatever, anything good happens in the series or in the comic, and, you know, they're starting to rebuild civilization, something's coming up to tear it down, like real life. But, you know, I want something that's going to be a little more hopeful. And don't get me wrong, I'm not really reading superhero comics either anymore. So I'm not looking for that either. So take it for what you will.
Well, we will definitely have to touch base on another Rant and Raise. We'll have to talk about what kind of comics you are reading.
Ooh, well, you know, a lot of the stuff I'm reading has something to do with a guy in a blue box, but that's a whole nother story.
It definitely is. Well, very cool. Well, I know that, you know, obviously there's people out there, and as we've gotten in our group, you know, we've talked on the Facebook group, and there are some people who are continuing to support Walking Dead like myself, and then there are other people that are like tapping out, they're bowing out because of this, that, or the other thing. So it is, you know, I mean, it's season 7. It's getting, you know, it's not one of those short seasons that, and, you know, I think because Kirkman's nature in the comic is, I'm just going to keep going. It's not a set story. It's just a keep going kind of thing. I think a lot of people will get kind of, after a while, just kind of get tired because they do want to see an end to the story. They do want to see at least a point where they can go and breathe a little bit instead of just continuing on. Although that's kind of the point of The Walking Dead, which is, you know, continuing on despite adversity. So it'll be interesting. I'm kind of curious because after this airs, I wonder what we're going to get from some of the listener comments, because we'd like to hear from people as to what they're enjoying about it, or not enjoying.
Exactly. We would definitely love to hear from you. It was interesting because I did read an article this week with Greg, and he said that basically that The Walking Dead TV show will never catch up with the comic. The comic will always stay ahead.
Well, obviously.
Yeah. So I found that interesting. And then also, of course, you had some of the, you know, other people out there going, you know, will the story ever end? And Kirkman says he does know how it's going to end someday. But he said there's, you know, I've heard, but then again, in other articles that I've read and or interviews with him, he said, nope, I have no idea. I don't even know what caused it. I'm just going with it.
Yeah. I've heard Kirkman say that, you know, he's just going to keep doing it until he doesn't want to do it anymore. And it's going to be interesting because at some point they're going to have to figure out how to end the show. And that finale is going to be really interesting. It's like, how do you end something that in the comic that Kirkman has no concept of ending? So it'll be interesting to see what decisions they make. So I'm curious about that too.
Oh yeah. I agree completely. So we'll have to wait and see. All right. Let's take a break, and, you know, write us, esopodcast.com, and we'll be back in a moment.
Hi, this is Ashley Pauls with this week's What to Watch. We had a bit of a quiet weekend at the box office last week, but this weekend we've got a really high-profile new release coming out. That's right, it's time for The Fate of the Furious. This is the eighth movie in the Fast and the Furious franchise, if you've been counting. And I figure by now, most of you already know if you're interested in this movie or not. If you're a fan, you're probably excited and looking forward to the next chapter in the franchise. But if you're not, there's probably not a whole lot that this eighth movie is going to offer if the previous seven movies didn't really win. This time, we've got a lot of the regular crew returning with Vin Diesel, Dwayne Johnson, and Jason Statham. We've also got a couple newcomers with Charlize Theron as a villain, and a bit surprisingly, Helen Mirren as another character in this film. Apparently, she really likes racing and wanted to be in the movie. We have Vin Diesel starring, of course, as Dominic Toretto, who's flirting with the dark side. I'm pretty sure he's not actually going to end up as a bad guy and betraying his family and friends, but you got to find a way to keep the suspense going with the eighth movie. So far, the critics are saying there's not really anything surprising about this movie, but if you're a fan, you're in for a really entertaining ride with plenty of car stunts and globetrotting adventures. If you're not into the Fast and the Furious franchise, there is another big movie coming out this weekend. We have also The Lost City of Z, which stars Charlie Hunnam and the new Spider-Man, Tom Holland. This one is based on a nonfiction bestseller and tells the true story of a British explorer of the Amazon named Perry Fawcett. Fawcett uncovers evidence of a new civilization in the Amazon. I've always been kind of interested in forgotten chapters from history, and this one looks like it could be really interesting, especially since I hadn't really heard this story before. This one's getting pretty good reviews so far. We also have a couple new movies coming out on DVD. A lot of the Oscar-nominated films are starting to trickle down into home release. If you're like me and didn't see quite as many of the Oscar-nominated films as you were hoping to, now is a really great time to catch up and catch them on DVD. First of all, we have Hidden Figures, which is a true story about a group of African-American female mathematicians who play a key role in the U.S. space race and help astronaut John Glenn's mission. This is a really inspiring film, and it's important in that it brings recognition to a chapter in history that sadly has been kind of overlooked over the years. So if you didn't get a chance to see this one in theaters, definitely check it out on DVD. We also have the movie Lion, which is about a young boy from Calcutta who is adopted into an Australian family. Even though he has a good childhood, he's still curious about his past and decides to try to track down his birth family. Well, that's it for this week. Be sure to tune in next week, and we'll be talking about a couple new releases, including an action comedy, a drama, and a documentary.
Do you like wrestling?
What?
Do you like wrestling?
Yeah!
Do you like podcasts?
What?
I said, do you like podcasts?
Oh, yeah!
Then do we have the podcast for you?
Everybody's got a place.
No, it's entirely free. We have a discussion about wrestling topic bi-monthly.
Two.
It's the
ESO Pro.
It's a podcast dedicated entirely to pro wrestling, past, present, and future.
Oh, will you stop?
There are also reviews, previews, and interviews. So tune in at ESOpodcast.com, and also be sure to check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/groups/ESO Pro.
And you can't beat that.
That's the bottom line.
Have a nice day.
Star Trekking across the universe.
On the Starship Enterprise under Captain Kirk.
Star Trekking across the universe.
Welcome back. Now we are here for the Geek Seat segment, and we are with a friend of the show, Lee Benjamin. I actually met Lee, two years ago at the show we met down, I guess, one of Mario's shows.
Perry.
Yeah, down in Perry. And he had the table next to me, and we just struck it up conversation. And We've been pretty much friendly ever since. And welcome to the show, Lee Benjamin.
Thank you, sir.
It's great to have you on the station with us. For those people who may not be familiar with you, tell us a little bit about yourself.
pardon me. I'm just this guy. But I've always been a Star Trek fan, and actually, you know, saw it in first run. So I'm pushing 60 this year, and I had never really participated much in the fandom stuff, in the conventions and all that, because for the most part, it always seemed like, man, it's expensive to go to these things. But back a couple of years ago, I latched on to a project that I thought was worth it. And, you know, you talk about the first convention you go to. Well, of course, most people, it's something small. No, I didn't bother with that. I just went right for Dragon Con.
You went for the big plunge.
Yep. It was for the Axanar project, and it was the first opportunity I had to actually help out, as opposed to, you know, giving them a little money here and dribs and drabs.
That's awesome.
And then since then, I've been to two more Dragon Cons and two Treklandas. As an aside, not associated with Axanar in any way, I did also go to the last Farragut Fest they had down in Kingsland.
Oh, we were down there also.
Yes. That was those were good times.
Yeah, it was really nice.
So I'm taking it from all your experience here that and you're mentioning obviously with your ties with Axanar, but is Star Trek really your primary, your first and true geek love?
Well, that's hard to say. A couple of friends of mine and I always said our problem was that we collect hobbies.
I know that feeling all too well, sir.
So, like right now, you know, I'm looking at the stuff I have on my my computer hutch, which has an extra bookcase sitting on top of it. And of course, there's lots of Trek stuff, but there's also some Star Wars, and there's some XCOM game stuff, and some Fallout game stuff, and general aviation stuff, and, you know, just stuff.
Sure.
Never been a problem with stuff.
I don't know. I seem to acquire too much stuff, so.
Don't we all?
I think that's most of geeks in the world right now.
I know, right? Hashtag
geek world problems. There's so much available, too.
Oh, yeah.
Excuse me. There's so much available, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Too much. Yeah. I mean, if you're diverse in your geekdom and you have a lot of interest, then yes, there's so much that's so tempting.
Mm-hmm. There's always somebody who wants to take your money.
Yeah, well, that's true too. So let's focus a little bit on Star Trek as far as what led you to become like more involved with sort of the fan film aspect of it?
Well, I just happened across there was a post in probably February 2014 that was on the Star Trek page that said, you know, hey, these guys are talking about doing a film. And I had never really pursued the fan film stuff that much. I mean, you know, everybody falls into their pocket of what they do on the internet. And most of the time when I bring up a browser, it's like, I don't know what I want to do, you know? So whenever I was on the computer, I was probably, you know, playing games and stuff. And I don't know, you know, hiding out.
But there was something about Axanar that kind of drew you in?
Yeah, I think it was the connection to the original series and the fact that somebody had taken this one little piece of Trekdom, the character of Garth of Izar, and the way Alec described that, at the end of the episode, you see this little glimmer of this once great man. It just spoke to me as far as, how a seemingly small thing can bloom into something or reflects on a big, long history. And you feel like you're right there at that point where it points in both directions.
So for those people who are not familiar with that deep into Star Trek, what is Star Trek Axanar?
Okay. In the original series, third season, there was an episode called Whom Gods Destroy. And it was a story of a character named Garth. I've forgotten his actual first name. Garth is his last name. And anyway, he was a character in this episode. He was a Starfleet captain. He had been in some kind of an accident and been injured, and these aliens helped him by giving him the ability to shapeshift. They did not realize, though, that in turn drove him insane. So along comes the Enterprise to drop off supplies at basically an insane asylum, which of course I can't remember the name of right at the moment. And Kirk realizes that Garth of Izar is one of the inmates. And the reason this is significant is because Garth, this great former Starfleet captain, had been the hero of a thing called the 4 Years' War with the Klingons. And he was very much, because of that and the battle that turned the tide in the war, the Battle of Axanar, his book about the tactics used was required reading at Starfleet Academy.
And because even more so, Kirk views him as a personal hero too, right?
That was what I was about to say, was that this was one of Kirk's personal heroes. And, with as much laud Kirk gets, there's nobody exists in a vacuum. There's a reason why people are the way they are. And this was one of Kirk's major influences, was this captain who we find out was a great explorer and was unwillingly drawn into the role of a wartime commander and turned out to have an aptitude for it. So what happens in the episode is, your typical Kirk comes in and saves the day and defeats Garth. And then at the end of it, Garth goes into rehab, basically. And he doesn't remember anything about what has gone on with his being insane and all this stuff. And he's getting up from a session where he's been treated for this condition. And he is introduced to Kirk. And he looks at him and he says, "Should I know you, sir?" And Kirk says, "No, you shouldn't." But in that moment, as Alec had said, you see this small glimmer of this once great man. And you realize how much it meant to Kirk to be able to meet him and to aid in his recovery. And that was what left an impression with Alec in the 70s when he was watching these episodes for the second and third time. And he's even then thought about writing stories about Garth. And that's where the Battle of Axanar actually takes place, the 4 Years' War with the Klingons, is about 20 years before Kirk gets the Enterprise. And that's one of the reasons that he's influenced Kirk, is because it starts out before that. And I forgot where I was going with that. But anyway.
But the idea being
that's where it fits into the Star Trek canon, is that this is one of the men who influenced Kirk being who Kirk was. And thus it's, historically important. And that was one of the reasons that when they decided they were going to make a film about Garth, they got the idea of doing this while in between the time that was the battle and when we meet Kirk. 20 years passed. Well, somewhere in the middle of that, the Starfleet Historical Society decided to do a documentary on the 4 Years War. And one of the episodes of that was part 3, which we now know as Prelude to Axanar. And that helps explain how it falls into the timeline of the Star Trek universe.
Gotcha. So, and what specifically is your role with the fan film?
I'm a guy. I just, every opportunity I've had, I've tried to help promote it.
Nice.
I mean, when they were starting out and they started up the Facebook group, it's like, I didn't even have a Facebook account. And I got on there, started communicating with these guys, and I liked what they were about and how they were doing things. And it's like, well, just go out and like everything you can that, where people, to help people get participating in this, to let them know that there are people out here who care what their opinion is. And, interact with people. And I've always tried to very carefully make sure that I never tried to pass myself off as anything I'm not, or try to share information that I didn't have or that wasn't mine to share. And then make sure that when people had misconceptions, to try and say, okay, this is not, I don't think you understood this right. This is my understanding of it. Not to say that it's necessarily right, but it's the best information I have, and here it is.
Right, because the production of Axanar has, we'll say it's created some waves. That's an understatement, I'm sure. What is the status of the film now as it stands?
Before that, I want to mention that, unfortunately, the haters always have a louder voice than the people who support things. And people who support things often will hang back, and all you can hear is the haters. So that's an unfortunate aspect of the internet.
Yeah. Anyway, as to the way it is now,
as you know, in 2014, they came up with Prelude. They did a bunch of the different shows. Prelude got a bunch of awards. And even before Prelude was made, Alec had talked to CBS Paramount and said, what are the rules? What is it that you guys allow and don't allow? And he could never get an answer out of anyone. The problem being on CBS Paramount side is, here they're sitting on, at the time, almost 50 years of contracts and different artists and studios and production houses and all this stuff that went on before. And it's like, unless somebody's directly stealing from us, we can't be bothered to figure it all out. And, in a way, you can't blame them, because there was all this history there, but they didn't necessarily conduct themselves well either, because after Prelude had success and they were getting ready to actually start up on doing the production of the film, after having had a couple of successful Kickstarters, and I think Indiegogo was involved at the time too, and different ways that now people can raise money with, I'll say almost not trying, but it's not like letter writing campaigns and stuff of the past where it would take months to even know if you're having an influence on anything.
Sure.
Anyway, so come late December 2015, Alec opens his browser and says, oh, look, a Hollywood Reporter or somebody, I'm not sure if that was a paper or what, but some paper said, CBS Paramount's throwing a fan film. And he goes, I wonder if that's us. Because at no time did they say, you've crossed the line or here's the line. At no time did they say, we wish you wouldn't do this. They didn't send a cease and desist. He just found out third hand that not only Axanar, but he personally had been sued. So it's like, you know, totally blindsided. So what do you do then? Well, you're within a month of trying to do principal photography. So about all you can do is shut everything down until you know what the heck's going on. And unfortunately, figuring out what the heck's going on and trying to figure out what to do about it takes a year. He was very fortunate in that, and of course I'm terrible with names, but he had a leading intellectual property law firm say, hey, we are very interested in the interaction between studios and fan films, and we're very interested in how these things form and develop. And they had supported previously other similar lawsuits. And they said, we're going to take your case pro bono. You know, you'll have fees and junk you got to pay for, but don't worry about the lawyers' fees themselves. And we'll come in and see what we can do to help you. And after a year, it was getting to the point where during that year, CBS Paramount announced Star Trek Discovery. They seemed to be rushing it because they didn't have much to share with people when they made their announcement at the 50th. And then they started delaying when it was going to come out. And they finally decided, it seems, that when January 2016 was upon them in February, and they had to delay yet again, they said, well, one thing that's not going to help us is this Axanar thing. So let's, you know, even though they had been talking together for the entire year, it finally came down to, okay, we need to make some kind of a settlement. And so they finally got together and hashed out the details. And the lawsuit was ended within a week or so of when it was supposed to go to trial.
Which is awesome, because so I remember hearing the news that they had settled. So so are things back on track? Is work being done, or?
Well, part of the thing is, you know, here you've gone a year not being able to produce anything, not being able to raise any money, and trying to keep the doors open. The facility they found was incredible value for the Los Angeles area, but you're still talking with the utilities and insurance and things, you're talking close to $15,000 a month. And when you don't have any money coming in, somebody's got to be paying for that. And they had some angel donors who helped out, but it came down to Alec with what he had been able to accumulate through his prop works business and whatever other means he has at his disposal. Basically, he had to spend his own money for 6 or 8 months to keep the doors open so that they could finally find out, you know, what's the resolution of this thing going to be. So at this point, it's or at the point of February, you know, it's April now, 2 months ago, it was, okay, now that's settled, what can we do now? You know, There's no money to do anything additional, because as was stated in the fundraisers, you know, the studio was built out, a lot of the pre-production was done, a lot of graphics had been commissioned, and although there were a lot of people who did a lot of pre-stuff, you know, still the graphics house they're using, you know, still had to be paid in order to produce things. people associated with the project came and went. And so the first thing you got to do is figure out what you got left and figure out where you can go with that. So the that, of course, you know, takes time, but everybody wants an answer. So you got to kind of say, hey, you know, give us a minute. This is what we would like to do. One of the consequences of the lawsuit and stuff was the guidelines that CBS Paramount was finally convinced to produce. The only problem with them being, I like to use the phrase, they were Byzantine and vindictive. Byzantine in that they seem to make a lot of demands of things that, like, you can't make your own uniforms. You got to purchase them from a licensed person or something. You know, you can only do 15 minute segments, and no more than two constituting a story. And of course, you know, that turns out to be kind of nebulous. What constitutes a story? You know, where does it stop and where does it end? And, you know, well, can you do a story that's after that story? But, you know, all of that has to be hashed out over time. And of course, the main thing that the corporation wants on their end, CBS Paramount, is the flexibility to say this project's okay and this other project isn't okay. And, you know, one hopes that when it's not okay, they'll start to engage with people and say, you know, what is it that's not right, rather than just blindsiding them like Axnar was. So anyway, now it's, you know, what can you do within the guidelines? So, excuse me, the current plan, since they obviously can't do a 90-minute movie, they did get some concessions in that Prelude Axnar is fine. There's no problem with it. It can be distributed free. Can't make any money off anything, but that can be distributed free as it has been. And it's seen over, well, almost 3 million views on the internet so far. The Vulcan scene, which was another scene where they did like a little vignette that was going to be part of the movie, because it's already out there and completed, they decided that was okay. So going forward, they said, okay, well, we'll do two 15-minute things, and we'll try to decide whether we can tell enough of the actual Axnar story for that to be worthwhile or whatever. So a few weeks ago, they had their own little internal summit to try and hash through some of these things. And at this point, it looks like what they're going to do is, since Prelude was episode 3 of the 4 Years War series from the Federation Historical Society, they said, okay, well, what we'll do is we'll do episode 4, which will be mainly about the battle. And so we can use the stuff that was in the, you know, part of the script for the battle. And then 5 will be about the end of the war and the peace conference. Now, the peace conference is significant in at least one major way for Star Trek canon. And that is during an episode called Court Martial, we find that James T. Kirk received the palm leaf of peace or something for his participation in the peace talks at Axanar. So that was another connection to the Garth character that that can be used. So that's what's up for the, hey, now we need to script these things and we need to figure out how we're going to pay for them and all that.
Very cool. It sounds like, well, I mean, it's good news. I mean, I'm glad it's continuing because I've seen Prelude and it's awesome. So I definitely encourage all our listeners to do that. And in the meantime, I guess we'll just look for official announcements. But it sounds like things are getting to get back on track.
That's what the effort is. Now,
there's awesome.
A couple other things that you know, but wait, there's more. sort of things. They want to take the, you know, one of the perks that was part of the early fundraising was an illustrated script of at the 90-minute movie. Well, even if they can't do the 90-minute movie, they can still do the illustrated script of the entire thing because it's not a video production. So it falls under the rules of fair use much more clearly. Another thing they would like to do, and here again, you know, this is all like to do and we'll see how it works out, is they would like to take the 90-minute script and do what amounts to a radio drama of it and have it available in that form. Plus there's, again, because of some of the perks that were promised, there are what would have been like bonus discs for the production that include documentaries about how Prelude was made, how the movie was going to be made, how you know, how they made their design decisions on, well, how do you make something that's 20 years before Kirk but doesn't look like Flash Gordon, you know, because you've right. got to let the aesthetic update a bit with the times, you know, so that, you know, they had to figure out those kinds of things. How do you make it look like it's, you know, 10 years after the Cage and, you know, 20 years before Kirk, or maybe it was 10 years before the Cage. I've forgotten the timeline exactly, but anyway.
Sure, sure. But those are definite challenges whenever you're looking at doing, you know, a prequel of anything. So,
well, look what they did with Enterprise.
Yeah. And, you know, so I definitely can understand that. But, you know, I can't help but notice that the chair, the geek seat is hungry, Mike.
It is. It is.
I mean, it's really hungry because it didn't get to eat last week.
No, it's been bugging us about it. And Lee, you're our victim this week. So,
uh-oh.
So welcome aboard. All right, Mr. Mike, you've slowly tied him up. I see already.
I have. I'm sneaky that way. I can get him now while they're talking.
Exactly. And you know, I know.
See, he just realized it.
He just realized it. Gosh, you have that soft touch. Amazing.
I was distracted. You got me talking and I couldn't stop.
So, Lee, are you ready for your first question in the geek seat, sir?
I believe I am.
What was your favorite geek out moment?
Well, I think high up on the list, at least, is back in the early-ish 80s, you may recall that there was a man playing Doctor Who named Sylvester McCoy.
Sure.
And it came to GPTV, and during one of their fundraising campaigns, he actually came to Atlanta, and more importantly for me, he came down to a comic book store in Macon and did a signing, and I got to go see him. I was on my way home. It was actually on my way home from work one day, and I stopped in there and met him. He's a very nice man. And I, because of the history of Doctor Who and how, you know, actors kind of come and go and of need, the one thing I did tell him was, I hope you're only the doctor so long as you wish to be. And so apparently he decided how long he wanted to be, and that was it.
Well, there you go. That's actually awesome. So
that was a lot of fun. Another thing was that my name, of course, is Lee, and I have a friend who's also named Lee. So we always have the debate, you know, who's Lee and who's the other Lee? So, of course, when I got pictures signed by Sylvester McCoy, mine was to Lee, and his was to other Lee.
Oh, that's so, awesome. Anyway. What was your most disappointing geek out moment?
Well, this was tough, but given what's gone on this year, I realized that the fact that Richard Hatch won't be able to be in Axanar as Karn is probably the most disappointing, because if this had been able to be made last year, as it was supposed to have, we would have seen Karn reprised in all his glory as one of the greatest Klingons who ever lived.
That is awesome.
And now we won't.
Wow. Yeah, I know. Sad to hear of his passing. It took a lot of the fandom, and I know he was pivotal to a lot of the things you guys were working on.
Yes, he was.
What geeks you out the most?
Well, I have to say Dragon Con, because you always see things you've heard of but never seen before. And then, you know, oh, I know what that is. Oh, I know what that is. Oh, I've heard of that. Oh, is that what that really looks like? You know, it's overwhelming, and in a good way, in a really good way.
Mm-hmm. Makes total sense. What turns your geek off?
Everyday problems. You know, you're in the middle of geeking out on something, and all of a sudden the dog's barking and wants to be fed. You know, the power goes off. You know, just whatever. You know, stuff that brings us back to Earth, so to speak.
Something that just slips you back into reality a little bit.
Yeah. Well, who needs it?
Totally understand that one. Get that every single day. What fictional character would you like to meet the most?
Speaking of whom. Well, I was always a fan of the 60s series Thunderbirds. If you remember, in the Super Mario Nation. And in the story of the Thunderbirds, which was the International Rescue Organization, the man who ran the organization was a man named Jeff Tracy. And here he organized a secret organization whose sole purpose was to go out and help people. And I think that would be a great person to meet.
I'm sure. What fictional character would you not like to meet?
Dr. Zachary Smith. The very definition of smarmy.
You're not the first person to bring him up on the show.
Yes, I'm surprised he doesn't come up more often.
It's like, I don't want to be around somebody who makes my skin crawl.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Oh, the horror, young man, the horror. What is your favorite geek word, phrase, quote, or pose?
Okay, I'm gonna have to go a little bit toward reality on this one. After a Gemini flight, it's gonna be hard for me to get through that. Gus Grissom said, if we die, we want people to accept it. We are in a risky business, and we hope that if anything happens to us, it will not delay the program. The conquest of space is worth the risk of life. And as you may recall, he later died in the Apollo 1 fire.
I remember
Ed White
that.
And Roger Chaffee.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
And I agree. The advancement is worth the risk.
I do agree with that. What is your ideal geek occupation?
Well, assembly code analysis, which happens to be my real job. So, you know, this is the lowest level of programming right there next to the hardware. Mm-hmm. And it gives me the out that if anybody says, hey, can you help me with my computer? I'll say, no, I know everything about the stuff you can't see. If it's something you can see, I don't know anything about it.
Actually, that's a little bit of a tie that we have to you also, friend of the show and also co-host of the DragonCon Report, Tacoma Sanchez. You used to work with her.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, she was a subcontractor working IT for my company. And she, in fact, just this last week had a going away party because she's going to be headed up your way.
That's right. She is an Atlanta gal now.
You're working up in Atlanta. And hard as it is to believe, she's going to commute for a couple months, which is like, oh, my God. Because it's like 120 miles each way for her.
Ugh. Couldn't even imagine that.
Yeah. Yeah. I can only imagine it because my wife at one point commuted 85 miles one way.
Sounds like how it was when people I knew when I used to live in LA. And that was mm-hmm. normal.
Yeah, really. At least in commuting up to Atlanta, you're doing highway speeds most of the time. Whereas in LA, it's like 20 miles an hour.
Good point. What geek occupation would you not like to do?
I would not want to design zero gravity toilets. And as with most of my answers, this is a two-parter. I have an uncle who did that for Skylab.
Mm-hmm.
That's and the true. Answer to your unspoken question, the answer to your unspoken question is peanut butter and oatmeal.
Oh, ah. So we'll move, I didn't we'll need to go there. I did not need to go there. Okay, Lee, what is your final question for the geek seat? Is what is your ultimate geek fantasy?
Hard to say, but Gene Roddenberry's original Star Trek concept comes pretty close. The idea being that we as a race can be better than we are. And I think we need to do more of that.
Mm-hmm. I like that. Well, Lee?
Well said.
Very well said. You have made it through the geek seat. Congratulations, sir.
Huzzah!
Yes.
Wow, it's good to have those straps off.
They're not off yet.
Yeah, I think he's just numb.
I think so, too.
Well, since I can't move my head, I can't tell.
Exactly.
That's right.
That's true.
That's right.
Exactly. Mike, you did a good job. Well, Mr. Mike, tell the young man what he's won.
You have won a lifetime subscription to the ESO Network, a value easily worth $40.02.
Wow. It may not sound like it, but inside I'm screaming like a little girl.
Well, that's because the blood is now really not in your rest of your head.
Yeah. Whatever you say. I'm being pliant now.
So, well, very cool. Well, do you have any conventions that you're going to be at in the near future?
I will be at Treklana.
Awesome. We will be there as well.
And then I'll be at DragonCon again this year.
Awesome. Awesome. And where should we go to find out more about all things Axanar?
I think it's axanarproductions.com. I did not anticipate that question, but I should have.
It's okay. Just send it to us, and we'll include the link in our show notes so that people can click on it and check it out.
All right. I think that's correct, but I'll be sure to double check that and let you know.
That is awesome. Well, thank you, Lee, so much. All right, folks, let's take a quick break, and we'll be back in a moment with our main topic.
Hi, this is Michelle with the Iconic Rock Talk Show Moment, and today it's a look ahead to Record Store Day, the 10th annual, coming up Saturday, April 22nd, which is also Earth Day. So we're celebrating Earth Day by driving around from store to store buying petroleum products. Okay, be sure to do some recycling or something while you're out there. If you're not familiar with Record Store Day, it's an annual event designed to promote and celebrate music and the independent record store. Every year there's special releases, a lot of them on vinyl, some on CD, and some other cool swag too, available only at a physical location of an independent record store. You will not find this stuff at Barnes & Noble, FYE, or Amazon. You may find it later on eBay at a really jacked up price. So get out there and support your local record retailer. There may just be a special event with some live music or party going on, so that's even better. Record Store Day covers every genre you can imagine, no matter how obscure your taste might be, whether it's Delta Blues or Bollywood, classical, hip-hop, jazz, big band, there is something out there for you. Some of the releases are Record Store Day exclusives. Some are limited runs, which means they're exclusive and very rare. And some are firsts, which means that they will be available later on at retail. This year's list has some really cool stuff, so let's take a look at the highlights. There are two Bowie titles this year, Cracked Actor, Live in Los Angeles 74, a five-sided album recorded on the Diamond Dogs tour. The sixth side is etched artwork. Also from Bowie is a special replica pressing of what was called the Bow Promo from 71, a very rare promotional-only LP with alternate tracks from Hunky Dory. This one features five new photographic portraits of Bowie included and recreates all the original artwork from the 71 release. Seven Prince singles are part of Record Store Day. Six of them are exclusive 12 inches, including Bat Dance, Party Man, I Could Never Take the Place of Your Man, I Wish You Heaven, Pop Life, and Sign of the Times. The other is an exclusive release of a 7-inch picture disc recreated from 1983 with Little Red Corvette and 1999. The Cure has two double LPs, Greatest Hits and Greatest Hits Acoustic, curated and remastered by Robert Smith. The Kinks reissue of the French EP of All Day and All of the Night from 1964 hasn't been in print for 53 years. There's a double album picture disc of Motorhead live in Germany from their last tour in 2015 called Clean Your Clock. Other releases include Jimi Hendrix live at St. George's 1965 and 66. That's a double LP. Stevie Ray Vaughan live at Carnegie Hall. Special reissue 7-inch of Peter Schilling, Major Tom. I told you you could find anything here. If you're really into soundtracks, Fawlty Towers picture disc with two episodes, one on each side. Star Wars Episode 4 EP with two tracks from the soundtrack, the opening theme and the throne room scene. Specially remastered LP version of the Dark Crystal soundtrack. And for Doctor Who fans, something very special, a double LP of Doctor Who and the Pescatons on 180-gram green vinyl with a second LP on orange vinyl of Doctor Who sound effects. There you go. Something for someone who has everything. Now, the things to remember about Record Store Day, these are all limited editions, and not every store will have every title, obviously. There's 420-some releases, so you may have to go to different stores. You may want to go to recordstoreday.com, take a look at the entire list, get a feel for what you're looking for, contact your local store, do a little recon and see where you may need to go, or if there's still time to order the title that you want. That may not be possible, but it's worth a shot. RecordStoreDay.com has the entire list of all the releases, both in a PDF that you can print and an online list that shows all the details and the quantities for every release for the exclusives, the firsts, and the limited runs. Everything you need to know about Record Store Day is on that site. It's also got the international lists for the special releases for each country outside the U.S. So, happy shopping. Enjoy Record Store Day 2017. This has been the Iconic Rock Talk Show moment. Check out the blog at iconicrocktalkshow.wordpress.com.
Hey everyone, welcome back. Now we are with our Artist Spotlight segment, and we actually had this one scheduled for a few months further into the year, but with the passing of Bernie Wrightson on March 18th, it was not by surprise, but we were hoping he was going to be able to hold on for a while more, and it's just proper that we pay tribute closer to his passing than later in the year. Because basically, Bernie is just an amazing artist that, you know, some might say he's a master of like terror and horror comics and just amazing stuff. And we have a great crew here to talk all about it this week. Let us, of course, you know, welcome Mr. Mark Maddox.
Hey, how's it going?
When you found out that we were going to be talking about Bernie, you were just like, I'm their favor, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, even before his passing, I was like, I want to be able to talk about him. He's an amazing man, this amazing person. So, yeah, thanks for having me on.
Oh, my pleasure. And another fabulous artist, we have Alan O.W. Barnes with us. Welcome back, sir.
Hey, great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, dude, it's great for you to be had. It's awesome. So how have everybody been? You know, it's been a while since we've talked to both of you gentlemen, and, you know, it's kind of fitting. We have two very talented artists to talk to about this amazing, you know, creator artist.
Well, I appreciate that. The thing is, I'm not a Bernie Wrightson quote unquote expert. I've just seen his stuff through the years. I bought it. You know, there's been things that he's done that I think can be considered pinnacles. I remember when I first saw him, a buddy of mine, I think the comic book Commandy came out, the first issue by Kirby, and I'd gone to the store and I grabbed it and immediately left the store. And then a buddy of mine had gone over there the same day, and he came back with, and I think that was the right comic I picked up, but he came back with this new thing called Swamp Thing, first right. issue. And he was so proud of his copy of Swamp Thing. And I was like, hey, let me see that. let me hold that. Let me look at that thing. And so I was looking at it. It was so different at the time. It's almost like the first time I saw Will Eisner. It was sort of like, I don't know if I'm getting this or not. But then I know, like, within a day or two, I was over at the store trying to get it, and it was gone. Mm-hmm. And over the years, I mean, I got Bernie Wrightson. It, you know, eventually I got it. I got his way. And you know, he was his style was you know, unique. It was a little bit. It reminded me a lot of Graham Engels from the old EC comics, but a little more controlled, a little more refined in a lot of ways. And that I only want to kind of start at the beginning. I want to start when the first time I ever saw him, because then we'll talk about other things. I don't want to run through his whole life right now. But Swamp Thing issue, that first issue, is really a super classic, and I think it's because of Bernie. Now, I know he had done fanzine stuff and things like that before that, but I went back and, you know, saw that stuff later. But that was the first time I ever saw him, and I was pretty amazed.
Mm. What about you, Alan?
Yeah, the first time I ever saw Wrightson stuff was actually not nearly that long ago. Maybe 15 years ago or so, I encountered a copy of the Frankenstein illustrations that he did.
Yeah.
And they blew me away. I mean, I had never seen that sort of slightly modernized Franklin Booth kind of concept applied to horror illustration, and I was just fascinated with it, especially because the black and white thing, the ink thing, is what I was really focusing on at the time as an artist. And man, I have probably studied those illustrations nonstop for weeks at a time in some instances.
Yeah, we're kind of we're racing right to what, you know, what Harlan Ellison called an astonishing document, the Frankenstein illustrations. That really, to me, is the pinnacle of his career. I think that even he knew it in a lot of ways. I think that the new Frankenstein stuff he was doing was fantastic. But this and it was right. Franklin, I didn't know who Franklin Booth was, and I got a fantastic book. I paid for the like expensive limited one decades ago, a book called A Look Back that was basically a Wrightson collection. And this was the first printing, and it cost me a pretty penny. And it talked about Franklin Booth, and that turned me on to Franklin Booth. And then it let me, you know, it's kind of funny because I used to, when I was studying artists that I really was impressed by, pen and ink artists, I found that you could go in and scan their drawings in and blow up a section huge, like enormous. Right. And it was almost like there was handwriting there telling you what they had done. If you yes. looked at it, you looked at it really huge. As a matter of fact, one time a buddy of mine, like, "Ooh, Franklin Booth," and we scanned a Franklin Booth piece in out of that Wrightson book, and we blew it up to a poster. and a guy walked by my office, and he goes, "Hey, did you draw that?" I was like, "No," you know. It was like the first time his eyes ever lit up looking at my work.
Right,
no,
right.
I did not, you know.
I know that feeling precisely. That's hilarious.
but with Wrightson, I mean, you know, he was telling you, hey, this is these guys here, these other artists from the 1910s and 20s and 30s, are the guys that got me to this point. And then he applied it to Frankenstein, one of our all time favorite subject matter. As a child, there would be like, what is it that's the most important to you? What's the most important subject? Frankenstein, doesn't matter. Frankenstein is the most important. And so to have him channel, and for him, obviously, it was the same thing. And he channeled that old style, perfect illustration into this subject and came up with this incredible book and the sheer amount of images in it. I mean, it was almost two steps away from being a big little book where there's like text right. on one page and a painting on the other page. I mean, you know, or a drawing on the other page. It was like, God, how many years did he spend on that? I'm not sure. It was like a decade or something.
Well, it's always amazing because the detail was just so prolific in a lot of ways. And how the darks and how he used the colors and the shades to, you know, to spell out the feeling that he was trying to get across with his artwork.
Yeah.
The mark making in those is ridiculous and amazing. And, you know, Booth, the way that he did it was by emulating woodcuts. And I think that was
it was a stupid mistake. He thought that was drawn line. In his stupidity, he created incredible pen and ink works by not having the knowledge to know that they etched
right.
on plates and it was a reverse. But but Bernie knew it. And
right.
Bernie goes, yeah, I know but the thing was, since Booth did it, Bernie could do it. There's something about the look of his work, you know, like even like with Swamp Thing, it was more bold. I mean, I'm sure he was probably inking with the brush, on those, that he really loved that feathering. He really loved to lay in heavy darks. I mean, he was a horror artist. He was a, you know, he was a guy that worked for Creepy and Eerie and did, he loved monsters. He loved hiding a lot of stuff to make things more creepy. I saw somebody posted an illustration of his the other day I had never seen before on an illustration website with this scientist. He's like, something's happening. He's falling on the ground. He's crawling all across the floor. And his eyes are almost completely blackened in. And all the line work and all the folds in the clothes, I mean, his old style, you know, like 200-year-old shirt, fluffy. And he had put all the line work in it and stuff, and that looked like it was done with a brush. And I stared at it for like almost 30 minutes. I'm like, you know, a great artist always leaves some information behind, and you learn, especially when you can see the originals or huge blow-ups of them. You learn from that stuff. And he was just fantastic at it. I mean, his ability at drawing that kind of stuff was amazing.
I was looking at – I follow a lot of artists on Instagram, and just today – Mitch Gerrards, who is actually working on Batman Monthly right now, mm-hmm. and he posted a work in progress of an image of Swamp Thing
that he had just done. And he said, quote, Swampy is a brush noodler's dream. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at that and I was like, I don't know what that means, but I'm betting that it has something to do with Bernie. Is that fair?
Well, I would say so.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're introduced to, especially to Wrightson's version of Swamp Thing, are you talking about like in a technique type way? Is that what you mean? Is that what you're
asking?
Yeah,
I mean, I'm not really sure what brush noodler means, but I'm assuming that it's something that, you know, that kind of that style.
He could have been talking about many things. I kind of that if somebody said that to me, I would think he would be talking about the way Wrightson with you know, because Swamp Thing had like little pipes running across right. the top of his skin, and it was like, you know,
things
whatever it was, yeah, things flowing across right. his body, like we would consider him, like if it was the Hulk, you would say, well, it's the bulging veins. Well, this almost looks like something that's grown onto him, like the vines. Right. And everything. So that's probably what he's talking about. But yeah, I mean, there's a fun thing that you get to a point where, you know, you've gotten past the hard part of a drawing and now you're texturing. Sometimes just on one of those days when you put on that punk rock album and you're just sitting there I'm texturing, and you're just right. sort of, you know, making micro strokes and building the shape. In the case of Swamp Thing, there's got to be a lot of people that did that, you know, the texture on his skin and everything like that. I mean, Wrightson had a blast doing it, and you know, I'm sure that every artist that ever was given the job had the same fun with it.
I would also think, though, that a figure like Swamp Thing, some artists would think, wow, I could get away with a lot. I could be really loose here. And when I look at Wrightson's work, it doesn't seem like there's anything like loose about it. There, it seems really tight. Seems like all the muscles, the shadows, everything seems very deliberate and very precise.
Yeah, he's it's labor. I mean, it's you know, whether he's one of those people that smiles while he draws or not, or is like what Mike Waringo said years ago on a podcast. He was like, man, drawing those comic books, it's hard. It's hard work. And I was right. glad to hear somebody say it. It's like, oh, I thought everybody was just sort of like, eh. But with Wrightson, you know, there was sometimes that you would be like, hey, in the new issue of Heavy Metal, Bernie Wrightson comic called Freak Show, they did it like in three parts or five parts or something like that. And it was like him still channeling the Frankenstein illustrations, but leaning right. back more to the comics. It was right around the time that the Creepshow illustrated book had come out too, but this one was more. I mean, it wasn't as finished as Frankenstein, but it was still like Wrightson in top form. And I remember, you know, every time the new issue of Heavy Metal came out, while that was going on, you go over there, and the final monster at the end was just insane, with like arms sticking out of the back of the neck and eyeballs in the forehead, and it was just like this gloppy creature at the end. The worst freak in the Freak Show finally gets unleashed at the last couple of pages of the comic. And, you know, Wrightson was just in, not only was he in full form, but he had gone completely psychotic with this monster at the end. And it looked like it took weeks. So I don't think Wrightson was, I don't know whether his actual, when he finally got all of his sketching done, whether his inking was loose. And he could be one of those people that, you know, okay, I'm inking, but some people agonize over it. I mean, they get hand cramps. It's like, you know, when right. you went and took tests in school, you know, you had to take the end of the year test or whatever, and your hand was cramping up. It depends, you know, on the individual, but I know whatever it was, there was a lot of hours put into those pages.
Totally agreed. But I would also say that a lot of those textures are the kinds of things that I think that the person you're referring to on Facebook who said the brush noodler's dream or whatever, I think that there are a lot of textures in the Wrightson look that are probably accomplished by literally him, as Mark was saying a moment ago, you know, building shapes. But how to put this right? I think that when I look at some of the Wrightson, especially the backgrounds, man, I think that he's just going for it. I'm not sure with like some of his the textury, like swamp woods that are behind Swamp Thing, or the rain or whatever. I think that in a lot of those instances, he's just like putting it down and waiting to see what occurs as a result, more so than having it like infinitely planned. I think he's thinking in terms of texture and less about the other. Now on his forms, on his figures, there's no way to do that without an extreme amount of planning. But the other, I think that he's really just having fun.
Well, you could tell how much fun he was having. Like we had mentioned a Swamp Thing, but look at like even some of the other characters other than Swamp Thing, like what he did with Arcane, you know, with the teeth and everything.
Sure.
And just and some of his minions. It was just amazing. And the thought that had to go into, you know, creating some of that, because a lot of that just went against basic anatomy.
Yeah. There are things too that he would jump. He would jump out of what we normally expect him to do and turn around and do something like Captain Stern, which was all sci-fi, you know, Buck Rogers-y sort of looking with this completely smug piece of crap, Captain Stern, and monsters and things like that. And it was nice to see him. He would push himself. He would go, you know, today I'm going to be different. Today I'm actually going to try to do something different. There was that. I was trying to think of a couple of the Batman comic. Although the Batman, what was the Batman comic he did that was like in five parts or four parts, and one of the issues was printed like backwards or something. I don't remember what it was. They really screwed up on it. It was the one with the monsters in the sewer or the cannibals.
Was that the cult?
Batman the cult was one of my favorites. I don't think there was a misprint there, but
I mean, everybody got it. It was like weird. Like they printed like 10 pages. The very first printing, there was like 10 pages printed the second time. So everybody's standing. It might have even been the last issue, and everybody's sort of like looking at it and looking at each other going like, hey, you know, but they had to quickly go out and reprint it again.
I must've got the reprint, 'cause I don't remember that. But, I will say that, you know, talking about my first experience with him, and I'm sure I probably saw Swamp Thing prior, but I didn't have any Swamp Thing issues or collected or anything like that. So, and I wasn't really into horror books per se, but I think really for me, my first couple of instances with Bernie Wrightson's work was the movie Heavy Metal with Captain Stern in it, and looking at his style animated there, and just loving that whole sequence. And also following it up with getting, you know, because he also, you know, published it in the magazine as well. And then and Batman the Cult, because as a Batman fan, I had never seen Batman taken to that extent as far as the character and the horror elements of it. Sure, I'd seen Batman, you know, in the House of Mystery or the House of Secrets, and they would do stuff like that. But I'd never seen anything like, and this is after Dark Knight Returns.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty dark, a dark tale. But what Starlin and Wrightson did with the cult was just brutal in terms of what they put Batman through. And it was really horrifying. And really made an impact on me. And I've been fortunate to meet Bernie twice, and I've had him sign both of those books because they mean a lot to me. They really Stern as a character is just awesome. And you're right, it's completely different. I mean, there's nothing horror related about Captain Stern. He's just a very playful, like, you know, Buck Rogers or, like you said, Flash Gordon type, you know, he's not even a hero really, but character, but he's so unique. And I always wanted more of him, but and he finally did do a whole series, but that was much later, and it was pretty cool, but that he didn't overdo that one. That's for sure.
Yeah. The one thing with Howard Stern, Captain Stern, that was one thing I really appreciated about that sequence in the film, is it helped me learn how to talk to my kids when they don't clean up your room. I'll kill you. Kill. The thing is that I, unfortunately, I am waiting or was waiting and maybe you guys can tell me or help me out with this a little bit about this newer Frankenstein thing that he was doing with Steve Niles. Now, I would call up images from it and go, holy crap. I mean, this is like, looks like lots and lots of beautiful Bernie writes it in top form. Can anybody talk about that? Because I'm sort of, you know, I was just going to go buy the whole thing all bundled up eventually, you know.
Well, I know that obviously the first adaptation that Bernie did with Frankenstein was in 83. I didn't realize it was published by Marvel at the time. But then in 94, they released a more definitive, I think, better edition by Dark Horse. And then it was announced shortly, well, actually quite a bit of years after that, that Wrightson and Niles were doing a comic book called Frankenstein Alive Alive, which was supposed to be a sequel. The thing is, I don't know much more about it. I mean, I don't know. I don't even know. Was it finished?
Well, that's probably one of my biggest concerns. I don't know. I mean,
it says here on the, I just looked it up on Wikipedia, and it says Wrightson won his first National Cartoonist Society Award in the category of comic books for Frankenstein Alive Alive in 2013. So I know some of it was released, but I don't know if it came out. I mean, if it was ever like fully completed.
As soon as somebody finds out, let me know. I just planned on picking it up. It's sort of like the way, you know, you binge watch Netflix. I was just going to wait for the whole thing to be done and just gobble it, you know?
Sure. Well, and you knew that that's what I was kind of waiting for too, because I knew that with Wrightson's work on it and all that, it was going to get a nice hardcover collection that was going to be right in, fit right in with the Dark Horse edition of Frankenstein, which if you guys don't have, it's just gorgeous. I mean, that's the way you put together a book. And so I thought, well, that's how they're going to put this other one out. So I'll just wait until that comes out and then I'll be good. But like I said, I don't know if it did. So I'm trying to find out. So while you guys are chatting, you know,
Only thing I had when Marvel published it, I don't know who it was it Eclipse? Somebody published the Frankenstein book in a slipcase hardback. I purchased it. I have since sold it, which I was always regretted, but it was signed by him and Stephen King, because King had done foreword at the beginning. But it's a beautiful book. But you know what? When that book in the 80s, when I kind of got back into comic books in the early 90s, everybody in their home had like four or five copies of that Marvel edition floating around in their house. You'd like buy them, like you go into a place, oh, we got a sale on $5. I mean, everybody owned copies, and it was like you'd buy them, you hand them to people that didn't have them, you know. Vagrant would be walking by down on the street, you'd buy them a copy. I mean, it was just like everybody had it and everybody respected it. And there's, given the fact that it's a, you know, 170-year-old novel, even at that time or whatever, that to have that many people just, you know, reading it and looking at the illustrations, which are very close to what's going on, is a pretty amazing thing. You know, it's like, I was hoping the next thing you do would be like Moby Dick or something, but you know, he's a Frankenstein fan, so that's why Frankenstein got done. But you know, still, I mean, think about it. I mean, oh, Gone with the Wind's at the comic book shop. Let's go buy it. You know, it's a classic, a very old, you know, Asimov always called it the first science fiction novel, man created through chemistry. But, you know, it's for me, it's kind of weird when I knew we were going to be talking about this a lot tonight, but for me, it's almost sort of like when you get to that point, it's sort of like the climax of a great movie. It's like where do you go from there? You know, he kept working, he kept doing great stuff. But it's sort of like Peter O'Toole, you know, doing Lawrence of Arabia. Where do you go from up? You know,
It says here that 12 issues were intended to be published, but only three were published. Oh. Only three were completed.
God, who could even hire to try to finish it up?
You don't. You just don't.
You don't.
Yeah. You re-release Frankenstein again in a nice hardcover. You include those three chapters at the end and just be done with it, I think.
Yeah. You put a nice forward and afterward in there from Mike Gordon.
Yeah, yeah, there you go.
I can't even imagine that would be. But
So that was my, you know, initial experience with him. But later on, I did really, I mean, I started getting involved about, I don't know, in the late 90s. I really was attracted to John J. Muth's work. Uh-huh. And through that, I started finding out more about the studio, which Muth wasn't part of. But in the 70s, right. Wrightson was part of this group of artists called the Studio. And it had Michael Kaluta in it, Barry Windsor Smith. Catherine Jones, right? Yeah. And I fell in love with all that stuff. If you guys know about it, talk about that a little bit.
It was the coolest thing, and so many other artists tried to emulate it, but it was like what do they call it? Lightning in a bottle, I think is the term. Right. It was literally bringing four incredibly talented people together, deciding that they would probably help stimulate each other creatively and everything by getting a New York studio place for them to work. And they would show up there and they, for lack of a better term, sort of egged each other on. It's probably sort of the way the Beatles worked. I mean, but the thing was, is that Paper Tiger, who was publishing really great art books at the time, went in there, photographed them working, got their paintings and stuff that were being done in there at the time, and camera copied them and produced this book that has become the stuff of artistic legend, especially within the fantasy world. You had four guys, and what it was is two of them are gone. You know, Jeffrey Catherine Jones is gone, now Wrightson. Barry Smith is still alive, right? I mean,
he's still alive, but man, you don't hear anything about him anymore. And I do kind of wonder about his status because, the last time he did anything was, or that I got anything from him was, he did those beautiful Opus hardcovers.
Yeah.
And in it, he talked about not only were they beautiful books, full of amazing art, but he also talked a lot about some of his beliefs, and they're pretty out there, some of them.
That's so, what I had heard. I'd heard a little about that.
So I don't know exactly, but I haven't heard anything about him one way or another, so I really don't know what he's up to.
Yeah, and the other person is Kaluta. Kaluta's still alive, but Kaluta has stopped, I think, has now recently decided he's not doing any more conventions, or if he is, it's very limited. Like somebody said, they even tried to get him to come to a pretty major one near where he lives. I think it's either New Jersey or New York he lives in, and it was like he didn't even show up. But the thing is, this is one of the things I was going around getting everybody. You remember the Shadow collection that Kaluta had done for DC, which I absolutely still revere. They did a hardback collection of that, and Wrightson had actually helped with some of the pages in one of the issues, and you could tell when it switches from Kaluta drawing to Wrightson inking, it's just a joy to behold. But I was going around and getting everybody to sign it, so I had Wrightson sign it, and I can't remember who wrote it. It was Len Wein. I don't remember who was the writer, but and of course Kaluta. But two of them are gone, and the thing is that we're talking about two guys that are too young to be gone.
Right. Anyone seen Better Things, the documentary about Jeffrey Catherine Jones?
Yes.
I want to see that. Where do you see it?
I mean, I know you can get the DVD on Amazon. That's all I know about it. It's called Better Things.
You can get it on Netflix, but you can't stream it.
Okay.
Got it.
So I know it's up there also, or at least it was.
Oh, man. I didn't know about it.
I heard an interview with the director, and it seems like a fascinating project, but I've never seen it.
To me, it was funny because, you know, Gordon, you know, kind of, I sat there and said, well, you talk about Frankenstein, where do you go? It's like, you talk about the studio. Well, okay, yeah, there's... We're now talking about something that's pretty incredible, and you kind of, now where do you go? Because so many people in New York, there were so many cartoonists banding together and trying to get their own studios and stuff put together, but I don't think it was that at that talent level. But
right,
the thing about those guys, and everybody knows this. I mean, I'll say this for the audience because us guys probably know this, but they would actually be like working on something and go, I'm just sort of not inspired today, and go over and look at what the other guy was doing. Right. And it would juice them. It would be like, oh man, I mean, now I'm psyched. It's sort of like me when I'm a little bit kind of down on artwork that day. You know, you go up on some kind of a art site or Heritage or something, you know, see what's up for auction. And man, by the time you're done looking at that web page, you're like, yeah, I'm got to get back over to the art table. But, you know, one of the things with Bernie was, did anybody ever see the Masters of the Comic Book Art video? Did anybody, the one hosted by Harlan Ellison?
I did not.
It's good. As a matter of fact, I think it's on YouTube. Somebody posted the whole thing. I purchased it when it was brand new, but it was Kirby and Eisner and Mobius and a few others. The guy that awesome. Did Cerebus and stuff. Frank Miller. Sims. Sims and Sims. Frank Miller. Sim and Frank Miller and Bernie Wrightson. So cool. You get a chance to hear him talk a little bit about his, you know, his thought process and everything. He was very young at the time. I don't know. Maybe we should talk about who here met Bernie. I know, Gordon, you said you met him once or twice.
Yeah, right? I met him twice. The first time was at Dragon Con, and I had my first issue of Captain Stern for him to sign. And he was a great spirit. I mean, he was smiling. He was very nice, understated, wasn't a very loud man, at least not that I know of. And very, he was very quiet, but yet, you know, I mean, you go to his table and you see all the artwork around and you're just in awe. He was not, one of those flashy guys for sure. And from what I understand, he's not, you know, one of those guys that had any sort of attitude either. I mean, I think he just kept his head down and did what he did. And he was really into, you know, the art of it rather than, you know, the popularity, whatever it was. And the other time I met him was at Heroes. Starlin was there. And since Starlin and Wrightson were both going to be there, I said, well, now I need to bring my issues of the cult. And so I brought those up and they weren't sitting near each other. And I don't make anything of that. So I got Starlin to sign it first, and then I went over and actually Wrightson was sitting next to Steve Niles. So I think they were at that time. I think they were working on the new Frankenstein series. So
right.
And again, he was in good spirits. Great to talk to, very happy to sign or talk about anything. I know that they were both, excited about the Frankenstein book. And it was great. It was not a bad experience at all meeting them. So, you know, you know, there's times when, and we all know it, right? There's times when they say, don't meet your heroes, but, Bernie was not, one of those times by any means.
I'd say don't meet 20% of your heroes.
If only about, you knew which 20 before which you actually met them, right?
That's the crapshoot, because I've had a few, and I think I've discussed this with you in private and won't do it on the show, a few people that I'm like, wow, you really are, as a person, a disappointment. But Wrightson, I met him, very sweet. It was weird because I remember one time I was working at a printing company. I've been working with them for over a decade. And it was a Saturday, and I was supposed to go to Heroes when it was tiny, way before any of you young whippersnappers ever went. But he was going to be there. I'm like, oh, my God, I finally get to meet Wrightson. And my boss says, got some printing stuff that needs to get done this weekend, and, you know, your name came up. It's your turn to do the weekend. And I'm like, oh, please, is there anything? And tried to swap with people, forget it. And I remember, you know, not being able to go, and it wasn't until like years later. And when I was going to meet him I was going to be on a panel with him. So I went from like, you know, one end of the spectrum to like now they've got me up there with him. Not that I'm at his level or anything, but still to be on a panel as here's another artist, Mark Maddox, here's Bernie Wrightson. Here's Eric Powell, you know, and his wife, well, this was at Dragon Con, his wife slipped. At their booth, slipped and fell and hit her head, and they had to take her to the hospital. And so he didn't show up to the panel, but I did meet him a couple of times after that. And like you said, Gordon, it was he was always very soft spoken, very sweet. And he had volumes and volumes of folders filled with artwork. I mean, you just, there's no way, unless you were like, you know, drinking Red Bull and you couldn't go through the sheer volume of stuff that he had there, pencil sketches and draw inks and all this other kind of stuff of amazing artwork that he'd done. He had the things I remember particularly was him doing designs for a proposed creature from the Black Lagoon movie.
Wow.
And his monster was pretty cool. I mean, I was like, and to say this is a strange thing, but his prices were reasonable. I mean, it was like, you know, $200 for a nice Bernie Wrightson sketch. That's nothing, you know. Right. But
oh, yeah, right.
But I mean, very see nice guy.
Pay like, yeah, more than way more than that.
Yeah, but he was, he was the first super famous artist I ever showed my portfolio to. You know,
really?
Yeah. So it was like. Him and Adam Hughes, like, we're sitting right near each other. So those were the two first guys. But
wow. So what kind of feedback did you get? That's interesting. What kind of feedback did he give you?
He gave me more information than I ever got in my life. He said, "It's nice." That was it. But he was sweet. I mean, he was nice about it. I think he sure. just didn't. It was almost sort of like the look at us. He's like, I'm out of my zone. I don't know. I mean, maybe with other people, but I said, you got any tips or anything? He goes, no, it's nice. That's what he said. awesome. And I was kind of like, okay, what's next? No, it's nice. You know, and Adam Hughes said the same thing. He goes, nice. He goes, just keep going. He goes, you're ready. Go get a job. I didn't get much information from anybody, but I talked with him later, you know, at different times. I met him once later at Heroes and stuff like that. He's this sweet guy. Sort of like funny because it's sort of like with the horror actors that are so famous for doing terrible things and they happen to be the sweetest people. I think Bernie was one of those people that, you know, like Boris Karloff or anybody else, he creates horrors. In an incredible way, but you know, they're probably the most passive and nicest people you could ever meet.
Right.
Yeah.
That's always the juxtaposition, isn't it?
So did you ever meet him, Alan?
Man, I'm embarrassed to say I never did get a chance to meet Bernie Wrightson, and I really wish that I had, but it was never in the cards for me.
Yeah.
I only really started attending conventions in earnest 2 years ago.
Yeah. So that would have been much too. Yeah. Cause unfortunately, I mean, that's the unfortunate thing is that he's been so ill for so long now. I'm glad that he's not in any more pain, but I mean, it was one of those things that was kind of just, you know, just dragging on for, I think almost like 4 or 5 years. That's a really unfortunate.
Yes, I mean, I remember when they said he was officially retiring from drawing, and I said, "This,"
which wasn't too long ago.
No, it really, you, like a few, you know,
about 3 months ago, and we were all like, "Yeah."
And there was a picture of him in the hospital bed, and you're like, "Oh, this is just complete suckage." I mean, mm-hmm. It's just, and not much longer than that, not much after that. I mean, you know, the man got up every single day and drew. I had a friend of mine. Who had turned me on to the Wrightson Look Back book in the 1980s. He was a Wrightson fanatic. He actually just looked in the phone book and drove to Bernie's house, like completely uninvited, like didn't call, didn't do anything, just got in the car, looked at the phone book, Bernie Wrightson in the phone book, took down the address and drove over there, said it was a wooden sign, like with, what do you call it, where you burn the numbers into the wood. Kind of thing.
Oh yeah.
Right. So he just drove up there, and his wife was there, and she was like, "Oh, hi, how are you?" And handed my buddy, as a buddy of mine, Brad Joyce, who actually did work at Marvel for a little while as an inker and a letterer and stuff. And he was like, he'd actually gone to the Kubert School, like everybody else I know except me. And she handed him a flower. She just pulled a flower from the garden and handed a flower. And he said, and she goes, "Yeah, Bernie's inside. Go on in." And he went inside and he's like, spent the day there just hanging out, you know, totally invited. But it was like, "Yeah, sure. Come on in." Kind of thing. Kind of like the stuff you heard about Jack Kirby, you know, when people would show up, you know, total like, "Hey, come on in." And, you know, that's nice. You know, it's like me meeting C.C. Beck. I'm probably one of the last people that ever saw C.C. Beck alive. I mean, that's a strange thing to say, but we called him because we found his phone number in a Florida phone book and called him, and he was not in good shape. But he said, yeah, you guys come over. So me and a buddy went over, put on suits and ties and went over there and visited with him for the day and in a hospital bed and talked with him all day. And he was great. And then, a couple of months later in the paper, my mom called me. She goes, hey, I got some bad news. A guy you went to visit passed. And that kind of stuff changes you. So, you know, if you get to meet people like that in an intimate way, and then they go, you ache, you hurt, you know. And I'm sure there's a lot of people with Bernie that are, you know, I mean, you can see the love out there on the web. I mean, you can see all Absolutely. The people post pictures, and it's, you know, still going on this, you know, weeks later. And what a loss. Him and Jones are too young to be gone. They're just too young. They should still be working.
Yeah. Oh, very much
absolutely.
So.
Absolutely. I was thinking they had just come out with, now, you know, Swamp Thing, which is probably his, as far as things that he co-created, characters that he co-created, is probably the most well-known. I mean, Swamp Thing's had, what, 3 or 4 movies, had his own TV series. I think he had a cartoon for a while, and then disappeared for a while. Now has come back with all this Justice League, DC Dark stuff. And as a matter of fact, DC just released DC Animated just released a movie called Justice League Dark, and it deals with Swamp Thing. And at the end, or on the Blu-ray anyway, they have a featurette which talks about Swamp Thing, the creation of Swamp Thing. And Len Wein is on it, featured on there. And unfortunately, I think Wrightson was too ill to be part of it, which is unfortunate. Yeah. They do have Kelly Jones on there talking about it, and because I know Kelly had a pretty good run on Swamp Thing, and I think it's pretty obvious that Kelly was very much influenced by Wrightson.
Yeah, Kelly's sort of like, I mean, I don't know much about that artist, but I remember him doing Dead Man, and it was like, hey, you know, I mean, Kelly's a very talented man. You can see the influence, but, you know, it's like somebody that's extremely, extremely good at imitating Frazetta. Yeah, go ahead. Keep imitating Frazetta and entertain me. And that's the same thing with Kelly Jones. Kelly Jones, I saw his Dead Man. He had this Dead Man Limited series one time. I didn't know who he was. And I saw, like, boy, this guy's good, you know.
So, well, it's interesting because Kelly Jones always reminded me of Bernie's work.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The feeling, the goth feeling from both of them. And when, especially, you know, there was a Dead Man series that he'd had done, and it's like, at first I thought it was Bernie doing it.
Yeah. Well, it's like I'm saying, you look at Bernie Wrightson and you see Graham Ingalls, or what he used to call himself, and you see Gasly. You look at Gasly, I mean, I saw the connection immediately.
Sure.
The open mouth, the screaming open mouth with a little bit of saliva, you know, where the saliva stretches in the open mouth from the top to the bottom and things like that. And it was like, I mean, you know, Bernie had to have people that influenced him too, you know, and I—that's where I would, if I was a CSI of comics, that's where I would go. I would be like, yeah, Graham, sure. For sure, you know.
Would you say that it's fair to I mean, to me, prior to the 70s, you know, to me, comics have a very. When I look at the ones from the 50s and 60s and into the early 70s, they've got this very established look. There's not a lot of variety. There's not a lot of style. I mean, there is, but it's more subtle. Things are pretty much like panel, 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 panel. You know, it's like, I mean, and with some exceptions, obviously Kirby is one exception to that. But and then what Marvel was doing kind of pushed the envelope a little bit. It almost seemed like in DC's response to that was to go a little bit more stylized and a little bit darker.
I think they also looked back with
Neil Adams on Batman.
Yeah.
And Bernie Wrightson on Swamp Thing. I think both of those kind of ushered in this whole like darkness in Yeah, absolutely.
I think they looked back. I think that those guys turned around, looked back, and said, "We're now that we've done Jack Kirby's Fantastic Four and we brought us into the 1960s, we're now going to say, hey, you kids, you missed a whole bunch of stuff that your parents grew up with, and we're going to run you through it, because Swamp Thing is kind of a Frankenstein. I mean, he even brings Frankenstein in. I mean, there's the Shadow with Kaluta.
Sure.
There's Neil Adams going, no, Batman used to throw people off of roofs, you know? And I think that that was a very, very good time for DC. It's very, you know, I don't know how to put it. It was sort of they were very mature in what they were doing, and I was gobbling the stuff up. And then what was cool about it is that you actually, DC to me was so close to being literature at that time that you found yourself going in the bookstore, getting the comic books, and they go, oh, there's a Shadow paperback, or there's a Mars paperback. It made it closer for you to go just and go pick up the books. You mm-hmm. know what I'm saying? Of that kind of stuff. Doc Savage. I think all the Marvel did Doc Savage. I'm saying there was that stuff where DC was pulling from kind of the classic aspect at that time.
Well, exactly, because Marvel was, like you guys were saying, was the superhero stuff and everything. But at the time, DC countered that in from the late 60s into the early 70s with like the House of Secrets and, you know, House of Mystery, you know, all that kind of stuff. And yeah, that was good stuff. It was awesome stuff. And Bernie was like paving the way on those series.
Right.
I think so. And I think it's one of the things that, you know, we did a few months ago, you know, we did our ESO book club on Sandman. And I think, you know, I think DC is the only place that Neil Gaiman and Sandman could have happened. I don't think it could have, like, I don't think that would have happened at Marvel. I don't think that would have happened at any other studio because of the work that guys like Wrightson did to sort of like lead that way. And like you said, Mark, it's a little bit more, we're talking about art here and art styles, but there's sort of a more of a literary sense to those stories as well. A sort of seriousness to them.
With one caveat, and I was thinking about this the other day, the one guy at Marvel in the early 70s who kind of, and if I'm not mistaken, you guys are the experts on dates and stuff, who was actually before Wrightson and was very Wrightson-esque, and I didn't even think about this until it just, Mike Ploog, who did the Frankenstein, he did a Frankenstein, and he did the Werewolf by Night, and then Gene Colan, who was doing Dracula. So but here's what I think with Marvel. They said, we were going to do the classics. DC said, we're going to do some horror stuff too, but we're going to invent our own. And they did. I mean, Swamp Thing is he is the Muck Monster. I mean, he's more famous than the Heap or
Man
anybody
Thing.
Else or Man Thing. Yeah, Man Thing was, I think, was Marvel's response, which Ploog also worked on, was their response to Swamp Thing. And I remember liking, you know, Man Thing, but, you know, I mean, you know, Swamp Thing, you know, I went back finally. I didn't read Swamp Thing until I was like almost 30 years old. I'm going, this is good stuff. I mean, this is good. I mean, it's Wrightson knew how to create a very dark mood. It wasn't like repulsive, though. It was just he had that universe in his head, and he put it out on the paper. Mm-hmm.
I agree completely with what you said, though, Mark, because you had Bernie on DC side and you had Gene Colan on Marvel.
Yes. Yeah. I don't want to not mention Gene, because the Tomb of Dracula stuff that Gene was doing was just as every bit as dark and moody, but in a much different way.
Mm-hmm. I remember
in a much looser way.
Yeah, I remember holding that first issue of Tomb of Dracula in my hand with a Santa Claus ringing a bell out in front of the store. I picked up that first issue, man, and I'm like, "Ooh, it's Marvel and it's Dracula. Oh my God, I've struck gold!" And it was great. It was a great run. I've got the essentials and everything else.
Oh but, yeah, me too.
I mean, I kind of miss that time. I miss that time on both Bernie's and the DC side, and that I really miss. What Marvel did when it got a little dark, because that Ploog Frankenstein stuff was awesome. I mean, it's really good stuff. But Bernie doing Swamp Thing and doing House of Mystery and stuff like that, it's kind of like, you know, what do we have now that is like that? I mean, I know there's the independence and things like that, but I wish we had more of that stuff now. I miss it.
Well, that's just it. I mean, as great as he is, and as much as he inspired Kelly Jones and oh man, I'm thinking of, and even in some ways, I think Mignola, right?
Oh yeah,
sure.
And all the ones that have sort of followed after that, there's only one Bernie Wrightson, right? I mean, you just can't make that again.
Well, I think that you have so many guys drawing. You've got anywhere from hundreds to thousands of guys drawing, and you go, oh, that guy's similar to that guy. But I still think somebody who knows Kelly Jones can pick out Kelly Jones. But absolutely, every one of us can pick out Bernie Wrightson.
Yes. Sure.
You know.
Exactly. Well, I
think one of the things that you were talking about earlier that speaks to this is the reactionary component. DC in the 60s was sort of seen as, you know, the books that you read if you're a kid. And the Marvel stuff was what you were reading if you were more cool with it or hip. Right. So I think that DC bringing the horror element to it was just a reaction, an attempt to not be seen as like the children's books, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think in order for us to have it again, it's going to have to be a reaction.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It is interesting to me. DC has always been sort of the concept book. I mean, to me, I mean, you look at their science fiction stories in the 50s and 60s. When I read them, they were called Strange Stories or whatever. It was, and they'd have Adam Strange Stories in there, but it was always like, oh, here's a giant, 300-foot ape with wings grabbing the Empire State Building or something. But Marvel was always like, okay, we got our superheroes, we got our good guys, our bad guys, we have the Stan Lee writing that gives them all humanity, we got Jack Kirby's great art. But DC was the one that, man, if you were trying to pull stuff to make science fiction movies or fantasy movies or concept movies where you turn something on its ear, that was where DC came in. That's always my opinion. I mean,
Star Spangled Interesting War that they're floundering in that area right now, then.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like Star Spangled War Stories, army men fighting dinosaurs. I
sure.
Mean, it's like, I love it.
No, you're
it.
Right.
I mean,
you're absolutely right.
But it's
right.
Juxtaposing. And, you know, Strange Sports Stories. I mean, I wish I was a kid again. I wish it was 1972 again.
All right. Hey, guys, we've been talking for quite some time, and we've actually got to wrap the segment up.
Okay.
Let's just go around real quick. What would you recommend for someone who's never seen Bernie Wrightson's work before to pick up?
Well, I would say two things. I'd say 73 things. I would say,
each pick two.
Yeah. Okay. There you go.
Well, I think the thing is that Alan and I are going to probably pick at least one of those things.
Right.
And everybody's going to pick the Frankenstein. So
Right. Pick
up the Frankenstein, but pick that up last. That's my thing. Pick up his cartooning stuff first. Pick up either the collected Swamp Thing or pick up the Cult or pick up, one of those things that's all kind of collected, or pick up the book A Look Back. They redid it later. I still think you can buy it pretty cheap. Somebody else bought in the late 80s, early 90s. They reprinted it, and I think they've even reprinted it again. Pick that up for an overview of Bernie and then go and get the Frankenstein book. And then the Swamp Thing. That's I said three things. I'm sorry.
Damn you, Mark.
I hogged it all. What y'all gonna come up with now? Nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
The studio book. Oh.
The studio book. Yeah, there you go.
I really stole it. Sorry, guys.
Okay, that's the show.
I'm sorry.
All right, Alan, what do you got?
Apologize right now.
Well, obviously the creepy and eerie stuff that he did, I think that, that's a really great way to see, the pen and ink work unencumbered. And,
just did that too.
Yeah. 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 So
also grab it all.
So unquestionably, but there was also this, the story that he did, Cool Air, that was, an H.P. Lovecraft thing that was done on duotone paper. And, I can't recommend it enough. It's beautiful, beautiful work.
Who published it originally?
Ooh, you're asking the hard questions. I don't remember right off the top of my head.
I remember I'm watching that episode of the show on Night Gallery. But I'm trying to think, would it have been Creepy or Eerie?
Could have been. Let me see if I can find it.
They Dark Horse basically put all the Bernie Wrightson's work. Warren basically did put it all into one book of the work that he did for them, and it's great. It's inexpensive as heck. I mean, it costs nothing, like $20 or something. Pick it up.
Cool. How about you? How about you two guys? What do you think?
Us?
Yeah.
What about Gordon?
I look, I have my favorites and you can't have mine because I have them signed are Captain Stern and Batman the Cult, because those were two very fun reads that I can enjoy over and over and over again.
Someplace in this house, I have a beautiful signed Bernie Wrightson print of Captain Stern running from some velociraptors.
That was on one of the covers. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Great stuff.
By the way, Cool Air was in Erie. So cool. There you go.
Mm-hmm. I it's cheap. It doesn't cost much. It's worth it. Get that and the Corbin one. Okay. That's a great one.
For me, folks, I would recommend, if you want to do some of his really like it's horror stuff, I would check out for DC. They have the DC Essentials that are out there, and you could find the House of Mystery stuff, and a lot of it is Bernie's work there, which is great stuff, folks, and some of the really stories which you would not expect to come from DC. And it's just a lot of stuff. And that's what I grew up with, truthfully.
Right. Right.
And you know, you guys mentioned the Swamp Thing stuff. So you guys are making it tough on me there. So also, you know, of course I want to say the Creepshow trade paperback.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That he did. That was basically the whole film, but illustrated. And it was awesome. I remember being a kid and reading it for the first time, sitting in a Barnes & Noble and just like drooling over it. And it was awesome. Actually, it wasn't even Barnes & Noble at the time. It was B. Dalton. How's that for dating myself? So, but yeah, and it was just great, great stuff. And then to be able to see the same things on film and actually liking Bernie's stuff better. So it was actually pretty cool with that. So, of course, we want to hear from you at home. Please write us esopodcast@gmail.com or call us at 404-963-9057. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll be back with Angela's Geek Girls Take and then the Con Report.
Things are falling down on me, heavy things I could not see.
Welcome to A Geek Girl's Take. I'm your host, Angela, and this week, this Geek Girl is talking about Rogue One. So, I've been a huge Star Wars fan since probably birth. My father showed me these movies over and over, and I remember on snow days, him taking me to the video rental store and asking me what I wanted to rent, since living in the South, everything shuts down for snow and ice. I always picked the Star Wars movies. I was incredibly excited for Rogue One. I knew the backstory, since it's the running credits at the beginning of A New Hope. But I was not prepared for the awesomeness that I was about to see. If you haven't seen Rogue One, you should probably skip ahead right now, since I don't want to spoil this movie for you. Go see it, like, right now. Just leave work and go see it. Trust me. First off, this story sucks you in from the beginning the movie starts. It has everything you need in a backstory for Jyn and her father Galen to then be thrust into modern times and their stories years and years later. I think my favorite character had to be K2SO. It's funny when a robot steals the show for you. And yeah, that seems to happen a lot in the Star Wars universe. However, the actor choices in the film were awesome and all the characters were amazing. And shame on you, Disney, for getting me attached to so many characters in a one-off film. I was also thrilled that Tarkin had a part in this film and a small Princess Leia cameo at the end as well. It really sets you up for A New Hope. Overall, I am so happy with how Rogue One came out, and I want to see it again in theaters since I loved it so much. Thank you all for listening to A Geek Girl's Take. What will I talk about next week? Well, you're going to have to listen to find out.
Things are falling down on me, heavy things I could not see. When I finally came around, something small. When I tried to step aside, I moved to where they'd hoped I'd be.
Welcome back. Now it's time for the ESO Con Report.
Con!
Well, here's a short list of events coming up this month and into May where you can find ESO Network personnel, starting with this coming weekend, April 13th through the 16th. It's Frolicon, and that is in Atlanta, Georgia. Mike Faber will be there on Saturday. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. All day.
You will be frolicking on Saturday.
I'll be frolicking at Frolicon. Probably right. I'll look like a deer in headlights most of the time there.
So if you see Mike Faber, say howdy to him. Is that a safe word?
It could be, depending on what activity we're participating in.
Yes, wherever you find him. So I definitely look forward to next week. We're going to have you and Darren on, and it'll be the con report should be most entertaining next month or next week. So I'm looking forward to that. Then the week after that, actually, I think it's 2 weeks after that. We've got April 28th through the 29th, Treklanta. As we already mentioned, Lee, who we had on a little while ago, will be there. And Mike and I will be there as well. We will be hosting a panel on Saturday afternoon, which is everything that we've learned from Star Trek. So it is not just where we're going to talk for an hour about what we personally have learned from Star Trek for a whole hour. Nope, we want to hear from you guys. So we want as many of you in the audience as possible. We are recording this for a future episode to air on ESO. So your voices will be heard. We want to hear what you guys have learned from over 50 years of this franchise, both serious and even, you know, kind of joking around. So looking forward to that. This should be a good time. Trekland has got a lot of great guests, and I'm really looking forward to going back there. We skipped out last year for some reason. There was a conflict, but Treklanta, we are back. So we'll see you there. Also going on that weekend, April 28th through the 30th, is RavenCon. That is in Williamsburg, Virginia. And Angela, the geek girl herself, will be there. She will be participating. She'll make sure you ask her about her ukulele and ask her about her Doctor Who themed cookbook, because those are the kinds of things that she's been up to, as well as I think she takes part in some independent movie making as well. So she is a geek girl of all trades. So she's in demand, too. She's on a few of these lists, including the week after that, which is May 5th through the 7th. And that is Wholanta. That is right here in Atlanta, Georgia. You might have guessed from the Atlanta part. This convention used to be called Timegate, and it used to be held Memorial Day weekend, but they've moved up the date and they've changed the name. So it's going to have a Doctor Who focus, but it's also going to be there's going to be a lot of programming about British television that's currently on. And they might even sneak in. I think they're even sneaking in a few Stargate panels, too, because they remember where they came from. But as I mentioned, Angela, the geek girl herself, man, I'm just tripping over that today. Angela, the geek girl herself, will be in attendance. So it'd be good to see her. She'll be on a panel with us. And when I say us, I mean the ESW crew. That is Mike Faber, myself, and Jennifer Hartshorn. Unfortunately, we will be without Mary, but good. We will have a replacement as Angela. Not that Mary can be replaced, but Angela will be filling in that spot. We may have a couple of other guests to be announced on that panel as well. Very excited on that panel. That'll be Saturday afternoon. What are we going to be talking about? Well, we're going to be talking about what we learned from over 50 years of Wholanta. What Doctor Who has taught us for the last 50 years, what we've learned from that, similarly to our panel at Treklanta. We're going to air that as an episode of ESW. We want to hear from you guys, so we want a bunch of people coming out and participating. It's going to be a great time. And Wholanta, no matter what the name of the convention is, it's always one of our favorite shows to do. So we definitely look forward to seeing y'all there. And if you've got a convention coming up, April, May, even into the summer and winter, we will be glad to help promote it. We'd be glad to help participate in it. So please reach out, because we love talking about convention.
So that's going to wrap up another episode of the Earth Station One podcast. I want to thank everyone for sitting through and enjoying talking about Bernie Wrightson. It was great. There's a lot of passion behind his artwork, and we all here on the show had a great, feel an affinity for the man. So let's thank our guests for joining us. Of course, Mr. Mark Maddox.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. Talking about this great artist who left us way too soon was a privilege. Thanks.
Oh, not a problem. Of course, my friend. And of course, Alan, thank you so much.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. It's always awesome to talk to you guys, especially about such an amazing talent.
Where can people find your stuff?
You can find me at alanowbarnes.com and alanowbarnes pretty much everywhere else, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, blah, blah, blah.
Okay. The blah, blah, blah part's the fun part to try to find them at.
Right.
So, you know, is that with one B or two? No.
One L.
Aha. Uh-huh, that's even better. And, of course, Mark, of course, could be found at MaddoxPlanet.com. And he has a great, great portfolio up there. And, dude, if you ever want to see some amazing artwork, these two gentlemen fit the bill. So definitely, you know, worth checking out. And, of course, Mr. Mike.
As always, it's my pleasure.
I want to congratulate you. I saw you had something personal going on this week, and I didn't know if you wanted to talk about it. But congratulations on already making your grade.
Well, I definitely have to take a moment and real quick and thank everybody. I've had some financial difficulties, some things that popped up that were kind of out of our control, so which happened pretty suddenly. And so I put the call out there for some assistance, and I was amazed, humbled, very honored that so many people came to assist us so quickly. Michelle and I are thankful beyond words. So if you are out there and you've thanked that you've contributed, you've sent prayers, you've shared our GoFundMe, or just even just sent some positive vibes, just even thought about us in a good way, I appreciate it. We appreciate it. And I hope that once the dust settles, we are in a position where we can pay it forward. So I am very, very, very grateful for everybody out there for their assistance.
It's you know, some, when you came to me and said, you know, you wanted to do it, should you? It's like, you know, it's your call, but, you know, we were all for it. You know, we had an issue a couple months back with our dog, and, you know, people came out of the woodwork who we didn't even expect. And I was so happy to see how quickly you hit your goal.
It was unbelievable. I had no expectations for that whatsoever. And it's been absolutely amazing.
Well, congratulations, my friend. We are very happy.
Thank you.
For
and
it.
thank you and Judy for your assistance with that too, and getting that set up and helping me make some decisions about that too. I appreciate it.
Dude, your family. Of course we would. You know, we wouldn't just kick you to the wayside. Well,
you just didn't want us, Michelle and I, living in the station here. That's what it was.
So. Well, you know, JD's enough right now. We don't, you know, we don't need a little howdy up here 24/7. And I don't know how we'd feel about all the cats. So
we are a package deal.
Yeah, I know. Trust me. I know. All right, folks, that's going to wrap up our show for tonight. We will be back next week, and we are talking about the films of John Waters. Darren is once again taking over the station, and I think he's going for the early years of John Waters. So a lot of the Divine films that he did, and it's going to be interesting to see. It's been a while since I've seen a lot of them.
Need a strong stomach.
Oh, and some of them, yes. So, of course, we want to hear from you guys at home, esopodcast@gmail.com, 404-963-9057. And that is what we have for this week, folks. You know, support the station, amazon.com. You could go through the ESO website, or just go to esopodcast.com/ESO Amazon. And every time you go there, help support the station. And if you bookmark it, it doesn't cost you a penny more. It just, not even any more clicks. You go do that and, you know, help the station each time. All right, that's it. I'm out of here. My name's Mike Faber. Have a great holiday if you're Jewish. And next weekend, have a great Easter if you're not Jewish. All right, we're out of here. Peace, and we're done.
You've been listening to Earth Station 1, a weekly podcast that explores the many worlds of all things geek. please write us at esopodcast@gmail.com or call us at 404-963-9057. And if we find what you say interesting, we'll put it up on the air. If you've enjoyed our show, please rate us or leave feedback for us up on iTunes. And while you're there, subscribe to our show or any of the ESO Network podcasts. We can also be found up on Stitcher Radio or wherever fine podcasts are found. ESO is also available up on most social media sites like Facebook, Twitter, and so many more. The show is brought to you by the fine folks at the ESO Amazon.com e-store, where right from our website you can find all kind of geeky goodness. And if you get something up there, you also help support the station. ESO also has a Zazzle store to buy cool ESO merchandise and such. Show your ESO love with something from Zazzle. To learn more about ESO, our website is esopodcast.com. The show is produced by Calico Productions. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you here next time on the Earth Station 1 podcast. Peace.
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses. Hit it.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek. Classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.